So good morning, everybody. It's Sunday morning. It's just gone 9 o'clock here in London. And welcome again to this Turning Towards Life project that Lizzie and I have now been doing. My son Noam said to me, "You haven't been doing this for 13 weeks, really, have you?" And I said, "Yes, we have." So this is week 14 of Turning Towards Life. And we are so delighted to be here with you this morning. I've been looking forward enormously to this source that we're bringing you today, which has been sitting beside me, beside my desk for many months. It's on the notice board next to me and has been for a long time. So it feels very exciting to bring this. So I think that's all I'm going to say for now. I'm going to say good morning to Lizzie and see what you want to say, and then we can dive in.
Good morning, everybody. I'm here in Cornwall and slightly grappling with my internet, so I'm sorry if I freeze or anything like that. I am, from having been in Findhorn last week, to also grappling with internet, I'm now in Cornwall with the other half of my family, which is very, very lovely. And I have been really feeling into and thinking about this source that Justin's brought, and the interesting experience I've been having, Justin, is that it's so enlivening, this, each of these 5 points in the poem. And I can find so much in each of them. So I'm so glad to be having this conversation. I really want to see what I can do to keep this central. I love talking about death anyway, because of what it brings. And so to deepen that conversation with some content and somebody who's really been studying the effects of being with death and dying, is, it feels really important. So I'm very glad to be talking about this particularly.
Yeah, me too. This came to me many months ago, and I'm not sure how it came to me. Somebody recommended this piece, and it moved me so much. So particularly the poem at the end, poetry's become so important, and there's something extraordinary about this poem. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce her name. Mona is her first name. I don't know that she was a poet before she wrote this poem that was the poem for her own death. And it's so extraordinary and so beautiful, but more than that, everything in this piece seems to me a huge wake-up. When I read this, it reminds me all kinds of things about the ways in which I can get lost in my own life and get lost in my own thoughts and in my own worries and in my own I think we might have started talking about this last week, Lizzie, when we were talking about wounding, my own sense that my troubles in my life are somehow unique. Like I'm, the world somehow orients around me and that I'm uniquely burdened or something. And then I read this and I'm reminded that it's not the case, and I'm reminded by people who are looking back from another place in their lives.
Yeah.
So it's such a gift. So should we dive in and start to read this and see what comes?
Yes.
So the background to this, I'm hoping if you're watching, you'll have found the link to this. So we're now publishing the links on both on Facebook and on our new turningtowards.life website, where we can keep all of the resources for these conversations that we're having. And it's a summary written by Stuart Brand from the Long Now Foundation, which itself is a fascinating organization, about a seminar about death and dying, which was run by Frank Ostaseski. So this is Stuart Brand's summary of something else, which I believe is recorded, and you can go and watch and listen to the seminar, parts of the seminar itself. And here it goes. In one of Long Now's most moving talks, Ostaseski began, "I'm not romantic about dying. This is the hardest work you will ever do. It's tough. It's sad. And it's messy and it's cruel. And it's beautiful sometimes. And mysterious. But above all that, it's normal. It's a boat we're all in. It's inevitable and intimate. He said that people think it will be unbearable, but they find that they have the resources to deal with it. And they regularly, not always, develop insights into their lives in the time of dying that make them emerge as much larger, more expansive, more real person than the small separate self they've taken themselves to be. That, or maybe I'll just read this next bit, Lizzie. That is one message that dying gives to living. Reflection on death, he said, causes us to be more responsible in our relationships with ourselves, with the planet, with our future.
Ostrzeski summarized the insights he's learned from the dying as five invitations to be present. Number one, don't wait. Number two, welcome everything, push away nothing. Number three, bring your whole self to the experience. Number four, find a place of rest in the middle of things. Number five, cultivate don't know mind. For number two, Ostrzeski quoted James Baldwin, "Not everything that can be faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed that is not faced." An example of number four, a woman who was panicking at her difficulty breathing was encouraged to try resting in the moment between breaths. And there she found the handle on her panic and relaxed into the situation.
Ostrzeski ended with a story. One day at Zen Hospice in San Francisco, he was in the kitchen reading a book called Japanese Death Poems. A tough old lady from the streets named Sono, who was there to die, asked him about the book, and he explained the tradition of Japanese monks to write on the day of their death a poem expressing the essential truth discovered in their life. He read her a few. Sono said she'd like to write hers, and did, and asked that it be pinned to her bedclothes when she died and cremated with her. And this is what she wrote.
Don't just stand there with your hair turning grey. Soon enough, the seas will sink your little island. So while there is still the illusion of time, set out for another shore. No sense packing a bag. You won't be able to lift it into your boat. Give away all your collections. Take only new seeds and an old stick. Send out some prayers on the wind before you sail. Don't be afraid. Someone knows you're coming. An extra fish has been salted.
So I'm feeling so moved by hearing the poem. And for anyone who hasn't looked at the source yet, follow this up, because there are some amazing photographs in here of Sono writing her poem, and also Sono after she died as well. It's very, very beautiful and moving. I think I want to, the place I'd love to start, Lizzie, is back with the five insights that Ostrzeski talks about. Mm. And I want to say something about number one, which is don't wait. Mm. It has moved me and struck me immediately how often I wait. Mm. How often I imagine that some difficulty or some difficulty I'm in will be best served by me kind of like hanging on as if it wasn't there. Mm. And it struck me that there's at least two different kinds of waiting, because sometimes waiting is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes something passes. But what struck me, Lizzie, most strongly about this, there's another kind of waiting I can do. And that's not really waiting. It's more like pretending it's not happening. And pretending it's not happening and hoping something will go away is different from, really different from what he's inviting us into here and what the dying are inviting us into here, because to welcome everything and to push away nothing, even if what you're doing is to bring your whole selves to the experience, even if what we're doing is allowing something to pass, to wash over, as in this extraordinary example of resting in the moment between breaths in order to have a handle on the panic that we feel. So anyway, I was immediately struck by, yes, I know this, number one. I know this way in which I can get into, it is actually holding my breath. It's like, here comes something I don't want to face, whether it's a conversation with someone I don't want to have, or a bodily sensation I don't want to have, or a fear I don't want to have. And I'm holding on. You can't see this, but I'm holding on to the table and I'm holding my breath. And I'm like, this will be over. And it never helps. So it's such an important reminder. I know for me, and I suspect for any of us who do this, that it's the other way to turn.
Mm.
Which is into welcoming it, even if it's terrifying, even if it seems like it's going to be intolerable. And then this part of bringing our whole selves and finding a place of rest right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I know when I've done this, I've been able to face way more difficult circumstances than I ever imagined. And live through them.
Mm. And as you're talking, Justin, I can't help thinking about this turning towards life phrase that we are taking to be the invitation, the continually, for me, unfolding invitation of turning towards life has this all in it. And so the connection of death and life seems so clear right now to me. And so in turning towards death, we turn towards life naturally because they're the same thing.
Mm.
And this don't wait thing as well. I definitely have all those things going on that you say about not facing things and just going, oh God, this is going to pass. Maybe if I just sit quietly, like this won't be as bad as I think or something. And I also feel like this whole process of you and I doing these videos on a Sunday morning into this group is one way that I found out how not waiting works. In some ways, we have waited for a long time and not done anything like this. And we've known each other for a good while where we could have been doing something like this. And we have been maybe hedging about a little bit. And then suddenly we just thought, let's just do it. And actually, thanks to Holly, my sister, and her group, Presence of Love, where they study a big text, she just said, listen, I've done this for a year, almost a year now. It's okay. You can do it. And that it was really inspiring to me. And I'm finding out that what you and I talk about naturally is also interesting to other people too. And that feels like a really big example of don't wait for me. And I think the other thing that strikes me in these five things, I mean, there's so much here, is finding a place of rest in the middle of things. For some reason, that's really moving to me to consider that and feel that, because I can feel my life often is like the word that's coming up is like a train. You know, I'm on a train. My personality is fast. I'm deft. You know, I'm kind of generally able in lots of different things. And so I find myself jumping from one thing to another. And actually, Justin, it's reminding me when we originally met and you helped me with my coaching program, that one of the narratives I had, one of the stories I had about myself, really deeply embodied, and I still have it, is being like a ping pong ball, you know, going from one thing to another and not landing. And I think it's a lifetime's work to find a place of rest in the middle of things. That feels like it's what really fulfills a life and allows life to be received and for it to enter. It, through my defense of fastness, or my defense of getting things done, or my defense of being in the world in a certain way. And so this feels like a really big invitation. And, you know, there are some things I'm kind of okay at, which is like, I don't know mind. I mean, I really genuinely don't feel like I don't know much all the time. I feel like my mind is open. And the more I feel like I know, the more I don't know. That's one thing I do know for sure. And then this thing of finding rest is like, my goodness, how to do that and how to cultivate that. And feeling when I do it, the filled upness that's possible, the receiving of life. And I've often said to myself, I think the work of my life is receiving my life and really being a body in a nervous system that can allow life into my experience, rather than trying to gobble it up or consume it or get hold of it or make the most of it, or, you know, all of those things. And to and let it in, what I cultivate, to let it in once I've cultivated it on a regular basis. A deep, confronting invitation.
That's really beautifully said, Lizzie, and I think, well, I find myself really agreeing with what you've said about what it means to find a rest in the middle of things, find a place of rest in the middle of things. And you talk about it as your own sort of personality, that this moving from one thing to another. And I also think it's almost certainly true of all of us, which is that we're taught this last distinction that you made between sort of grabbing and grasping and shaping and making our lives, which of course is one important side of things. We're not, most of us, well practiced in receiving our lives. And my experience more and more has been that in order to be able to do that, in order to have a still point in the midst of everything where I can receive whatever's happening, takes lots of practice. It doesn't come just because I wish it. And so sometimes when I take myself off for various practices that have become important to me, like the sitting meditation practice that I do, which is solitary and quiet, and apparently nothing is happening, and I'm not moving anything in the world, and I'm not changing anything in the world, it's of great value for its own sake, but it also turns out to be helpful exactly in the way that you're saying, which is that right in the middle of the happenings of life, I have a little bit more of a chance of having a way that I can receive life as it happens. And even if what I'm receiving isn't welcome, and that seems to me is the profound invitation here in these five, is they could sound like they're just nice bits of advice for living a fulfilling life or something. Mm. And in a way they are. But I think it's also really important to remember that these are written out of some of the most trying circumstances that anyone can face. This is what to do when our bodies are totally out of our own control. When things are happening that we didn't start, that we're not going to finish, that, you know, this story here about breathing, about not being, what to do when it's difficult to breathe. And even then, what he's pointing us into is having a part of ourselves that can receive our lives. Even then, maybe it's striking me that if we don't work on this in one way or another, then what happens is we end up being absent from our lives, because either we find ourselves in trying circumstances and we have no facility to be in them, so we turn away, we deny them, we pretend they're not happening, we fight them, we hold ourselves back from them, all of this kind of stuff. So there's that, like right in those moments of crisis or transition. Or but it's immediately striking me that the consequence of that is that we do that the rest of the time as well, because something's going to happen. I better get myself ready for the something that's going to happen by already practicing exactly the opposite of everything here, right? Mm-hmm. I'll push things away. I'll hold back parts of myself from the experience. I'll mm-hmm. make sure I'm trying to be in control of things. I'll try to know everything from end to end so I'm on top of it. And he's saying, no, often that doesn't help. So we need to, it really helps us to start practicing these things, because we're mostly already practicing the opposite in anticipation of the things we don't want to have to face.
Yeah, I think it speaks so beautifully to the paradox of being a human. And 100,000 paradoxes, like the tighter you hold on to something, the more elusive it gets. You know, those kind of things that make your brain go, oh God, why, how could that be? Like, that's not logical. And, you know, as you're talking and listing the opposites here, it's like, you know, we could make up a paradox for each of these five things. And to me, that feels like a really beautiful continual inquiry of the illusory nature of all the ways we try and control things, we try and fix things down. And so many times the very opposite happens than our intention when we're coming from the place of needing to fix or control or shut down. And this feels like a big old invitation into that inquiry, and to have answers or responses that are genuinely from our experience to those questions as well. You know, to practice these five things. Like, if I cultivate a don't know mind, how might I have a mind that can know even more? You know, it's like of grasping, I could let thing land in me because of a great capacity that I find, rather than like reading to the hilt to find the answer to something. And it feels like a big liberating move as well, just like in a really ordinary human way. Like, it's really hard work to keep grasping and to keep going and to keep on the treadmill of things, thinking that there's somewhere to get to. Like, I can feel it now, even as I say it, like that feels exhausting and my chest kind of feels tense and I go a bit desperate, like, oh God, is there somewhere to get to? I've got to keep going because there's somewhere, but I don't know what it is, but there's somewhere. And to feel this invitation and to feel how humane it is to practice these things and allow life to be in our experience rather than trampled over somehow. I think we have a natural tendency to just trample over life, and to stop and allow feels deeply humane. And, you know, one thing that's really striking me, Justin, is, you know, so last year we had two very close deaths in our family of my dad's dad and my dad's stepmom. And that beginning paragraph that is in this article about it being, above all, being normal, and that normality being the origin of this wisdom. You know, the ordinariness of seeing my granddad a couple of days before he died, and how it was so not glamorous. It was so not, like, the angels did not descend audible to me anyway and sing a song or something. It was really hard. And his death was hard. And simultaneously beautiful, but not in the same, not in the way that a flower is beautiful, the way you can feel the redness of a poppy and see the shape that creation made. Although, as I'm saying it, I could say that about the way that Grumpy died. But it was really hairy, you know, and physically hard, emotionally hard. But because also we had some of this in our beings to cultivate in the moment with him, we could be there. But it's the normality of death and the fact that we all have to face it, and who knows what our deaths are going to be like. You know, death can come in so many different ways. And so to be in receipt of what this normality and this ordinariness of a body not being the way a life happens anymore, but there's a different way, which who knows what happens when death comes. To be in the teaching of that, to be in the what gets born from facing the normalness and also the tragedy and the everything. I mean, it's huge. It's really huge. And I feel really glad to be in receipt of what's coming from a study of the normalness of dying and mess of dying and the probably horror and, you know, joy and whatever. It feels like somehow, we talk about these things, Justin, and each of the topics we have feels like, oh my gosh, we should, like, this should be all we talk about. You know, it feels like a big, big fat gift that we could study forever to be in this inquiry.
I think we could take any one of these five and study them for a year.
Yeah.
So by talking about this entire source for half an hour, who knows, one day we'll hatch a way of doing that.
Yeah.
As you've been talking about your recent experiences, Lizzie, and your family, I'm remembering a conversation I had with my father-in-law a couple of days before he died. Either I had this or Davina, my wife, had this conversation with him, and now I can't remember who had the conversation with him. And he said, I haven't died before, he said. I've never done this before. And it was really beautiful conversation to be in, and it was so true, which is that in each of our lives, maybe with death most particularly, but we find ourselves facing something we don't know at all. There's a way in which we do know it because our bodies know what to do, but there's also a very profound way in which we don't know. This is totally new. Something as huge as ending. And these five points that he lays out are kind of like one side of a great polarity. Sometimes we need the other side. Like, sometimes it's really helpful to know, and sometimes it's really helpful to wait, and sometimes it's really helpful. But this is a reminder of the side that we often don't pay enough attention to, and maybe particularly don't pay attention to most when we need it. And as you were talking, I was thinking, there's our own deaths, and there's the deaths of the people we love and who are close to, or people we've just met or whatever. But there are all the endings of everything that we face every day that we also don't know, because they're the first time they've ended. When a career ends, or a relationship ends, or something that I've dedicated myself to for years, I find I'm not dedicated to anymore. Mm-hmm. Or my body changes, or you know, I could go on this huge list of times when we face the death of something and it's the first time. And then what do we do?
Yeah.
It's the 10th time. What do we do? And this, it seems obvious to say, what beautiful, important advice. But to bring our whole selves to it, knowing that we don't know, and finding that within us which can rest right in the middle of not waiting and can welcome what's happening. And this amazing line from James Baldwin, that the first thing that we have to do is to face what's coming, because nothing else will come until we face, even nothing else may come. But no other possibility will open until we face what's here, until we... And that's probably a lifetime's work, because somewhere along the way, most of us learned to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is the, you know, as you talk about your experience with your own most immediate encounter with death, I think, yes, this is what we so need to learn from this, because this is what will enable us to live, even right in the moment of our own dying.
Yeah. Yeah. And Justin, as you're talking, what's the experience that I'm in is one of encountering this thing called faith, where so my mind went to all those faithful beings who are present to people's transitions and who have not died themselves, and yet of course things have died 1,000 times in their life, but not this particular thing of letting go of their body, and yet they have this faith to be with the transitioning. And in the same ways, you know, you and I have this faith with our clients and ourselves and our families in lots of ways, where we continue facing rather than turning away. So rather than turning away from a death, like a transition of one of your kids leaving school or going to a different school, or, you know, identities being dropped because our age changes and, you know, all those things, we do our best to stay present to those transitions. It seems to me to be able to face this in ourselves, this faithful path of confronting and facing into what death can bring, we become more able to be present to life. It allows us to be the people that we'd really rather be, you know, that rather than running away and saying, oh, deal with this on your own, or I can't handle this, or I'm out of here, or whatever. We get to cultivate the kind of body, the kind of presence, the kind of heart that can be with, rather than flee or defend or protect, whatever our response might be. We get to probably be that, but there's more. There's a way we can also stay, and we can also be present to, and we can also open into and inquire more deeply into something, because we consider these things and we practice them and find a place for them in our lives, find a space to build and cultivate these very things that are taught to us by, in this case, through the stories and the wisdom and the experiences of dying.
I think this is what Sono Mona's poem is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, Lizzie, if maybe we would end, you read the poem the first time, I'll read it this time, and then maybe we can finish there, because her words echo so beautifully what you've just said from where she was standing. Don't just stand there with your hair turning grey. Soon enough the seas will sink your little island. So while there is still the illusion of time, set out for another shore. No sense packing a bag. You won't be able to lift it into your boat. Give away all your collections. Take only new seeds and an old stick. Send out some prayers on the wind before you sail. Don't be afraid. Someone knows you're coming. An extra fish has been salted. So thank you for this morning, Lizzie.
Thank you, Justin.
And I want to say again, thank you to everyone who's taking part in this experimental, crazy project that we're doing. It's such a joy that we get to be with you and you get to be with us, and the conversations that are spawning off in all kinds of directions, both the ones that we know come onto the Facebook page, but also I know now from speaking to other people, the many conversations in the world that get started from here. So I know that we're both enormously grateful for that. And we'll be back on Sunday morning next week. And the other thing I wanted to say is, please tell people who you think might benefit from being part of this, tell them about it. And you can now very easily point them towards turning towards .life, which has all of the information and how to get involved. And that would be wonderful.
So everybody, week, 8 o'clock Sunday.
See you next week.